I think there's no reason to delay. Let's just go on the record right away and say that the time and place to hear testimony on stipulation and dockets numbered 11-035-200, 12-035-79, 12-035-80, all of which relate, or at least tangentially relate, to Rocky Mountain Power's rate, most recent rate case. So we're here to hear testimony this morning on the stipulation. We'll first hear from the proponents of the stipulation, and then opponents, if there are any. Later today, 5 o'clock-ish, we'll conduct a public witness hearing here in the same hearing room. So unless there are items we need to discuss before we commence, we'll take appearances. Ms. Hobel, do you look like you had something to say? No, you're just ready to go.
Well, I was just...
Raring to go.
I was just wondering if we want to take care of the admission of the testimony to work at court.
In fact, let's try to do that expeditiously after we enter appearances.
Okay.
And since you have the mic, Ms. Hobel, why don't you begin?
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners and parties. My name is Yvonne Hobel, and I'm here on behalf of Rocky Mountain Power. With me here today are Dave Taylor, who will be presenting a summary in support of the stipulation, Mr. Bill Griffith, who is here to answer any questions related to any cost of service, rate design, or rate spread issues, and Mr. Steve McDougall, who is also here to answer any questions that you may have about revenue requirement issues.
Thank you. Ms. Schmidt?
Thank you. Patricia E. Schmidt with the Attorney General's Office for the Division of Public Utilities. Also with me is Justin C. Jetter from the Attorney's Office for the Division of Public Utilities. As our witness today, we have Dr. William Powell.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Proctor?
Paul Proctor on behalf of the Utah Office of Consumer Services. Ms. Beck will be the witness today.
Thank you. Mr. Dodge?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Dodge on behalf of UAE, and Kevin Higgins is here in the room as UAE's witness.
I see him there in the back. Yes. Yeah.
Vicki Baldwin on behalf of UIEC.
Ms. Hayes?
Thank you. Good morning. Sophie Hayes on behalf of Utah Clean Energy, and with me is Sarah Wright.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Holly Rachel Smith, and I'd like to enter an appearance for Walmart Stores, Inc. and Sam's Glass, Inc. Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome in person for the first time, I guess, at least in recent memory, but we're happy to have you here, Ms. Smith. Are there others who are going to participate this morning? Yes.
Good morning. Rob Dubuque, representing Western Resource Advocates.
Would you mind spelling your last name for the record, please?
Dubuque, D-U-B-U-C.
D-U-B-U-C, okay. And is anyone participating by telephone? I hear a clicking on your phone.
This is Captain Sam Miller, appearing on behalf of the Federal Executive Agencies.
Thank you, Captain.
And this is Jody Kyler, appearing on behalf of the Kroger Company.
Okay, thank you. Any others? I noticed in the stipulation that all parties agreed to the admission into evidence of all of the pre-filed written testimony with exhibits. Can we just do that in one fell swoop, do you think? Or do we have to go piece by piece? All right. I would entertain a motion then that we admit into evidence all of the pre-filed testimony in these three cases.
Mr. Chairman, can I add all the pleadings as well?
And the pleadings as well.
Thank you.
Good suggestion. Although they're part of the record anyway, but yes, let's include them all. Are there any objections to the admission of all the pleadings and pre-filed testimony in this case? Seeing none, they are admitted. Okay, with that, let's begin then. I guess the company would like to go first, probably.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, you're going to have, okay, right. Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give in this proceeding is to speak the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. And you may stay there at council table if you like.
Good morning, Mr. Taylor. Can you please state your name and position yourself in Mountain Power for the record?
Yeah, I'm David L. Taylor. I'm employed by Rocky Mountain Power as the manager of regulatory affairs from the state of Utah. My business address is 201 South Main, Suite 2200, Salt Lake City, Utah, 84111.
And what is the purpose of your testimony today?
I will briefly review the history of events and the key elements of the stipulation that have been entered into by nine parties. Those are signatures are listed on the stipulation. I also will confirm Rocky Mountain Power's support of the stipulation and the company's belief that the stipulation is in the public interest.
Can you tell the commissioner what dockets were settled by the stipulation?
Yes, this stipulation settles the general rate case, the docket 11-035-200, the deferral of the project plant decommissioning, docket 12-035-79, and the deferral of not unit 3 development cost, which is docket 12-035-80. Approved by the commission, this stipulation resolves each of these dockets. The two deferral dockets and a number of additional issues are included in the stipulation because it's a multi-year settlement, a multi-year agreement. Because, as I will cover later in my testimony, Rocky Mountain Power will not file another general rate case until 2014 at the earliest. As a result, there's issues that would need to be resolved within that time frame, and those issues, therefore, have been addressed in this stipulation.
Can you provide the commission with the key elements that led to the stipulation being considered today?
Certainly. On February 15th, 2012, Rocky Mountain Power filed a general rate case requesting approval of a rate increase in the amount of $172.3 million. There were several rounds of company and intervener testimony, and on July 13th of 2012, the parties filed the rebuttal testimony in the rate case phase of this docket. The company's rebuttal testimony, it reduced its rate increase request to $155.7 million, based on updates or corrections to its direct testimony and acceptance of certain adjustments that were proposed by intervening parties. Over the course of this case, Rocky Mountain Power filed testimony of 20 witnesses that included the 2,200 pages of testimony and exhibits in support of this request. 11 intervening parties filed the testimony of 27 different witnesses. And in addition to the 160 filing requirements that were included with their application, the companies responded to over 2,800 data requests, including subparts of data requests. The intervening parties have prepared their responses to the company's case. I point this out to show that prior to entering into this settlement and into settlement discussions, the company has presented a substantial amount of evidence and a substantial amount of discovery has been provided to the parties, and I believe the parties have thoroughly reviewed, analyzed, and evaluated all of that evidence. Over the last few weeks, the parties have engaged in settlement discussions, and based upon those discussions, the parties have agreed to the terms and conditions set forth in this stipulation. The stipulation addresses a significant number of issues. Individual parties have placed greater weight on different issues in order for those parties to become comfortable with the agreement, and I will let those individual parties, if they choose, discuss which elements of the stipulation are of significant importance to them. The signed stipulation was filed with the Commission on August 7th, 2012. And while not all of the interveners in the case have signed this stipulation, we're not aware of any party that opposes the stipulation.
Can you describe the terms of the stipulation for the commission?
Certainly. Let me address each paragraph of the major terms of the stipulation. Again, I'll go paragraph by paragraph. I assume that the stipulation has read, the commission has read the stipulation, so I'll try to only briefly touch on the key terms. And in doing so, I do not intend to modify any of the terms of the stipulation in any way. And if by chance I misspeak, the language of the stipulation, not my words, are the binding agreement of the parties. I trust the commission will let me know if I'm giving you too much detail or too little detail and you want the pace of this to change. So let me just...
I will say, interrupt and say that we have read the stipulation. So that assumption is correct.
All right. Starting with paragraph 25, the parties agree that the company should be able to implement a multi-year rate plan. That plan will provide a measure of certainty to customers while affording the company a reasonable opportunity to earn its authorized rate of return to cover its cost of service through at least August 31 of 2014. In reaching the stipulation, the parties considered and relied upon a number of different factors, and not limited to those which are listed in this paragraph. Paragraph 26 is clear that other than set forth in the stipulation, the parties have not agreed to any specific adjustments or regulatory issues, principles that were at issue in the docket. Now, the key components are as follows, and the parties have agreed to the following agreements. In paragraph 21, discusses a step one rate increase of $100 million or paragraph 27 describes the step one general rate increase of $100 million or approximately 5.6% to become effective on October 12th of this year. Mm-hmm. Paragraph 28 addresses a step two general rate increase of $54 million or an additional 2.9% to become effective on September 1st of 2013, providing that the Mona Oker transmission line is in service by that date. If the Mona Oker line is not in service by that date, then the step two rate increase and any corresponding changes to net power cost or renewable energy credit revenues will be delayed until that transmission line is placed in service. I will state that the target service date of that line is May of 2013, well in advance of the agreed upon date for the step two rate increase. So we don't anticipate that to be an issue. Paragraph 29 talks about cost of capital. The parties have agreed that the allowed cost of capital will be as shown in Table 1, listed in the stipulation in this paragraph. That reflects a 9.8 return on equity with 52.1% common equity. The next paragraphs discuss net power cost. Paragraph 30 states that base net power cost in the amount of $1.479 billion annually on a total company basis or $636 million annually on a Utah basis will again be the base net power cost, including rates. Table 2 in this paragraph reflects the stipulated level of base rate EEA costs as shown on a dollars per megawatt hour basis. These values were calculated and developed using the scalar method, similar to the calculation that was used in the settlement, the last of the GRC stipulation, with just one exception. The total monthly EEA base cost were then divided by Utah megawatt hours at the sales level or at the customer meter, while in the last case they were presented in dollars per megawatt hour at the generator. I think that's more in line with the commission's directions in developing the EBA. The calculations of the values in Table 2 are found in Exhibit A1 to this stipulation, and Exhibit A1 also shows the allocation of EBA cost among rate schedules. EBA costs that shown in Table 2 will become effective on the step one rate increase of October 12, 2012, and will be used as base NPC costs until such time as those are reset in the general rate case or some other proceeding that will be filed on or after January 1 of 2014. Paragraph 31 deals with the currently issue still pending in the outstanding the EBA docket 12-03567. Again, that's pending a decision before the commission on certain issues. This agreement does not attempt to either prejudge or influence the commission's decision in that docket. However, once that commission decision has been made, any balance of deferred net power costs and associated carrying charges that are determined by the commission in that docket will either be collected or refunded over a two-year period from the effective date of that approved rate change, and there will be no carrying charges applied during that two-year collection or refund period. Paragraph 32 addresses the EBA filing to be made in 2013, and the EBA cost as determined by the commission in the March 2013 EBA filing will be collected or refunded over a two-year period, and carrying charges will accrue to those costs through December 31 of 2012, but there won't be any carrying charges beyond that date, nor during the two-year collection or refund period. Paragraph 33 discusses the reporting of the EBA calculations. In addition to the calculations shown in a base net power cost in Exhibit A1, the company will also exhibit base net power cost by the method set forth in Exhibit A2 and Exhibit A3. Those shown in A2 is the method that was laid out in the commission's order in the EBA docket, and the method shown in Exhibit A3 is a calculation using monthly jurisdictional allocation factors as opposed to an annual jurisdictional allocation factor. That was recommended by some of the parties in the case that we present that information on an ongoing basis. Again, the net power cost, or the EBA cost, as used for base rates are those set out in Table 2, which were calculated using the SCADR method. The next few paragraphs deal with the renewable energy credits and the 2013-2014 revenue balancing account. In paragraph 34, base rec revenues in base for the RBA purposes will be $25 million, effective with the step one rate increase on October 12th of 2012. The base rec revenues for purposes of the rec balancing account will be set at $10 million, effective with the step two rate increase, which will happen on September 1 of 2013, again, subject to the terms of paragraph 18 and some more open mind being in service. Paragraphs 36 to 38 address the collection or refunds of REC revenues through that balancing account. For calendar year 2012, the commission determined the difference between base and actual REC revenues for that year, 2012, will be recovered or returned over a one-year period from the effective date of the approved change, and that will include a carrying charge. Going to the next paragraph of calendar year 2013, the difference between base and actual REC revenues for that year will be recovered or returned over a three-year period, with no carrying charge during the collection or refund period. Again, there will be carrying charges up until the collection or refund begins, but no carrying charges during the collection or refund period. And then in paragraph 38 for calendar year 2014, the difference between base and actual REC revenues will be recovered or returned over a two-year period, again with no carrying charge during that collection or refund period. paragraph 39 discusses an incentive to encourage the company to market renewable energy credits. It allows the company to keep 10% of the revenues beyond the sales of RECs that are billed in through May 31, 2013, incremental to the $25 million that have been reflected in the revenue requirement filed with the company. And for REC sales after May 31, 2013, that 10% will be applied to contracts entered into after July 1st of 2012. A table listing those contracts as of July 1st, 2012 are shown in confidential exhibit B to this stipulation. The next few paragraphs discuss the future rate cases. Paragraph 40 discusses the timing of the next general rate case. The company agrees in this stipulation that it will not file its next general rate case, which is identified as a defined term as the 2014 GRC, will not file out or a major plan addition case prior to January 1st of 2014, with the rate effective period prior to September 1, 2014. Again, I note that this term, the 2014 GRC, is a defined term. It's used subsequently in several places in the stipulation, and it applies to the next general rate case whenever that occurs, even if it's after the year 2014. Again, it's still identified as the 2014 GRC. Paragraph 41 describes the test period to be used in that case. The company files an application prior to March 1st, 2014 that the company will use and the parties will not oppose, a forecast test period from July 1st, 2014 through June 30th, 2015 with a 13-month average rate base. If the company files its application on or after March 1st of 2014, a test period ending no later than 16 months from the filing date will be used. Paragraph 42 discusses the commission's action request on cost of service. In the next general rate case, the company will address issues raised in the commission's action request, specifically related to the treatment of cash, working capital, interest expense, and income taxes. Moving on, the next couple of paragraphs deal with the depreciation study that is currently being developed. As required by the commission order, docket 07-0513, the company will file the required depreciation study by December 31st of this year to be reviewed during 2013. The stipulation requests that the depreciation rates have an effective date of January 1st, 2014 for the purposes of financial reporting. However, the effective date ultimately will be determined by the commission in the order in that depreciation case. The commission-approved depreciation rates will not be reflected in customer prices until new base rates are implemented on or after September 1st, 2014. Paragraph 44 deals with a deferral of the impact of the new depreciation rates between the date they become effective for financial reporting and the dates they're reflected in customer rates. The company will request the commission to approve an accounting order deferring track for future recovery any aggregate increase, net increase in Utah allocated depreciation expense that exceeds $2 million annually, or to refund the customers any net aggregate decrease in Utah's allocated depreciation expense beginning January 1st of 2014, or another date, a different date is approved by the commission to make those rates effective. Until these new depreciation rates are reflected in customer rates, again, that's on or after September 1st of 2014. The amount will be the difference in the depreciation expense calculated using the rates approved in this new depreciation order compared to the depreciation rates that are in effect as of the date of this stipulation. This, again, how this mechanism will work is further described in Exhibit C to the stipulation. Paragraph 45 describes how the recovery or refund of that deferral will work. Beginning on the effective date of the 2014 general rate case, any amount in that deferral will be amortized over a period not to extend beyond June 30th of 2031, and it will include no carrying charges. This is a 17-year maximum amortization period, and that was just determined using the average remaining life of the electric plant in service. Any recovery or refund will be allocated to customers as determined by the Commission in the 2014 general rate case and in future cases as modified by future cost of service studies and allocations proposed and approved in those cases. The company in the 2014 general rate case will propose an allocation method for that deferral amount, and all parties will have a right to respond to that allocation method in that case. Now, other is expressly stated in this stipulation, nothing here limits the parties' rights to take any position that they might deem appropriate in the company's depreciation case filing. Also, the Carver plant and the plant's dam facilities, depreciation related to those facilities are not included in this deferral, and the accounting treatment of those issues are described later in the stipulation. So let's move on to one of those. The next few paragraphs discuss the Carver plant. Paragraph 46 request that the company approve the pending application of a deferred accounting order, and they should approve two accounting orders in that docket. The first one, upon the retirement of the Carver plant, to transfer the remaining Carver plant balances from electric plant in service and accumulated depreciation to a regulatory asset. That's referred to as the remaining carbon balances deferral. And the second accounting order to authorize the company to book to a deferred account removal costs associated with the carbon plant. And that's referred to as the carbon removal cost deferral. Paragraph 47 describes that the amortization of prudently incurred remaining carbon balances should be amortized from the date of transfer to regulatory asset through 2020. This is consistent with the pending request that's before the Commission in Docket 12-03579. Paragraph 48 discusses recovery of the carbon removal cost. The Commission's order approving this stipulation should authorize recovery of prudently incurred carbon removal costs from the retirement date of the carbon plant through 2020. The paragraph then describes how the mechanics of how that depreciation rates will be calculated and how the removal costs associated with those depreciation rates will be identified. Paragraph 49 describes that neither this stipulation nor a commission order authorizing a deferred account order for such costs should be construed as determining prudence or how and when any prudent costs are to be recovered. The paragraph then describes how updates to removal costs will be addressed in future cases. Again, other than is expressly stated in the stipulation, nothing in the stipulation shall limit the party's rights to take positions they deem appropriate regarding the prudence of the recovery of the carbon removal costs. However, paragraph 50 states that in those arguments, the parties agree not to argue against cost recovery of the remaining carbon balances or the carbon removal costs on used and useful grounds Or in other words, they won't argue that it can't be recovered because the plant has already been closed. Moving on to paragraph 51, this addresses treatment of any incremental revenues in the current FERC rate case, that's again pending before the FERC. This is essentially a continuation of the agreement in the last stipulation that Utah's share of all revenues are booked to FERC account 456.1. Again, that's squeezing revenues from third-party entities that result from the pending FERC rate case, including any refunds that the ultimate resolution of that case may provide, and that are incremental to the FERC revenues projected by the company in this docket from July 1st, 2012, which is the end of the test period in the last the GRC, through the effective date of the 2014 GRC. Once that FERC order has been issued, the company will pass through 100% of all such incremental revenues in its next annual EPA filing, and the deferral of those incremental revenues will not accrue a carrying charge. The next few paragraphs deal with the deferral of the non-unit 3 development cost. Paragraph 52 recommends the commission approve the pending non-3 development cost application in accordance with the terms of the following paragraph, which is that Utah's allocated share of the unit 3 development cost of $7.9 million will be deferred and fully amortized by September 1, 2014. In other words, that will provide full recovery of those costs prior to the effective date of new rates from the 2014 general rate case. And there won't be any dealing with those costs after that point in time. Next few paragraphs address cost of service, rate spread, and rate design. As laid out in paragraph 54, Exhibit D to the stipulation lays out the step one and step two rate increases allocated to general tariff customer classes and applied to general tariff customer rates. Exhibit D also includes monthly billing comparisons for the major rate schedules for both the step one and step two rate changes. This paragraph identifies that special contract rates are not established by this stipulation and will be governed by the terms of the applicable contracts approved by the commission. The paragraph also identifies issues related to the residential customer charge. The parties have agreed that beginning with step one rate change, the customer charge for residential customers will increase to $5 a month for single phase customers and $10 per month for three phase residential customers. Paragraph 58 is an agreement for the company to propose for cost of service studies a new plan for stress factor study. Paragraph 55 states that if for cost of service purposes, the company agrees to propose a plan to develop a new stress factor study, and that plan will be developed by July 1st, 2013. We will request the commission hold a technical conference to review the plan, and at least 2 months prior to the next general rate case, the company will provide that completed studies to interveners. Paragraph 56 describes some changes to Rate Schedule 8. Rate Schedule 8 should be modified to allow any Schedule 8 customer whose peak load has not exceeded 1,000 kilowatts for a period of 18 consecutive months to be moved back to Rate Schedule 6. Currently, the tariff requires 36 months before a customer could return to Rate Schedule 6. And prior to filing the 2014 general rate case, interested parties agreed to discuss alternative provisions for Rate Schedule 6 and 8 related to these issues. I note for the benefit of Artie Powell that this agreement does not require the DP to write a report on those discussions. That was a very important element to Mr. Powell. Paragraph 57 talks about bill messaging, particularly for residential customers, and parties that are interested will meet by November 1st of this year to discuss potential ways to improve the bill messaging to residential customers. Those discussions will be completed by February 1st of 2013. And if there's an agreement on how to better present that information, customers will make our best efforts to make those changes prior to the 2013 summer rate season. The next several paragraphs deal with issues related to the Klamath Hydro facilities. Addresses basically three categories of cost. Accelerated depreciation, relicensing and process cost, and removal cost associated with the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement. Paragraph 58 addresses accelerated depreciation. The agreement is that to depreciate the Klamath Dam facilities on an accelerated depreciation basis from June 1st of 2012 through December 31st of 2022. That's 3 years longer than was proposed in the company's filing. It's anticipated that those rates will fully depreciate the asset by the end of calendar year 2022. The agreement is the company may recover a return on and a return of that investment through calendar year 2022, even if the plant is shut down prior to that date. In other words, it will continue to have rate-based treatment of those assets. This depreciation life may be reconsidered if there's a material change in circumstances with respect to the relicensing and decommissioning of the Klamath Dam facilities. Paragraph 59 addresses relicensing and process costs. The agreement is that the recovery of Utah's allocated share of those relicensing and processing costs, currently in the amount of $81,814,435, are included in rates in this stipulation and should be included in future rates. Those costs will be amortized to be recovered over a period from October 12, 2012. Through the end of calendar year 2022, that will include a carrying charge at the authorized long-term cost of debt. In other words, this will not have rate-based treatment, but the relicensing cost will have an asset with the carrying cost of the debt rate. Paragraph 60 addresses the treatment of the removal-related costs associated with the KHSA agreement. The words of this paragraph were crafted very specifically and very carefully, so I am not going to attempt to paraphrase them. The Commission has read those words as they are, and I'm not going to attempt to try to put them in any different words than what's laid out in that agreement. If the Commission has specific questions, I'll do my best to answer them. Paragraph 61 addresses the solar incentive program that's currently proposed before the Commission in the docket 11035104. Again, this is not, this paragraph is not to presume a Commission decision or to influence a Commission decision, but assuming that program is approved prior to the Step 1 rate effective date of October 12, 2012, any approved surcharge to recover the cost of the program will be included at the time of the Step 1 rate increase. Parties have agreed that surcharge will not be shown in a separate line item on the bill, and how this is to be done as was described in that filing. Again, agreement to this stipulation does not apply the support or opposition of any party for that solar program. Paragraph 62 again deals with special contracts. The rate spread shown in Step 1 and Step 2, shown in Exhibit D, reflects additional revenues from base rate changes to special contracts in effect as of the date of the stipulation. However, increases for special contract customers, including those related to the EBA and the RBA applications, shall be governed by the terms of those contracts. Some additional terms in the stipulation, again, as we've just on paragraph 3, says that this the testimony will be entered into evidence. Entering in that into evidence does not represent agreement by the parties on any position taken in that testimony. Paragraph 64 says that upon commission approval of this stipulation, neither of the motions described in that paragraph need to be resolved by the commission, and that no party needs to respond to those motions. Paragraph 65 explains that, again, except as otherwise provided herein, the parties have agreed that not to seek a new deferred accounting order for costs incurred or revenues received before September 1st, 2014, unless the need for the order is caused by a natural disaster or emergency, or any request resulting from the division or office carrying out their statutory duties as laid out in state law. The parties agree that the EBA and RBA mechanisms will continue on their normal schedules. And that concludes my review of the major elements of the stipulation. Try to clarify that in case I did. Back in paragraph 39, it is discussing this incentive to the rest, the 10% incentive. Combination Exhibit B lists the contracts that were in place as of July 1st, 2012, those contracts basically are excluded from that that 10% treatment. It's for revenues incremental to those included in those particular contracts. So I apologize if that was unclear.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Do you have any final comments on the situation?
Yes. I want to thank the parties for working together to reach this agreement. I can say that getting to this point took a lot of work. It was really, really hard. But everybody came to the table and worked in good faith to reach the agreement that we presented before you today. It contains a lot of things and a lot of understanding, a lot of agreement needed to go into place to reach this agreement. It was negotiated in good faith by the parties. I believe the stipulation is in the public interest. And I recommend the commission approve the stipulation as filed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Taylor. I think we'll reserve commission questions until we've heard from all of the proponents. Does anyone wish to cross-examine Mr. Taylor? Assuming not. Ms. Schmidt, do you have a witness, please?
Thank you. Dr. William Arty Powell is the witness for the division. May he please be sworn?
You may please stand, raise your right hand. You swear that the testimony you're about to give in this proceeding shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Yes.
Thank you.
Dr. Powell, by whom are you employed and in what capacity?
I'm employed by the Division of Public Utilities, and I'm the manager of the energy section.
In that role, have you participated on behalf of the division in this docket?
Yes.
What is the purpose of your testimony here today?
I will offer the division's positions on the stipulation, in particular in support of the stipulation as it was filed.
Please proceed.
Okay. Good morning. Mr. Taylor has gone through a detailed explanation of the stipulation, so I won't touch on every aspect of the stipulation. What I'd like to focus on are those aspects of the stipulation that the division believes support our recommendation for approval of this stipulation as providing for fair and reasonable rates and also a reasonable opportunity for the company to earn its allowed rate of return as defined in the stipulation. Therefore, the division recommends that the commission adopt the stipulation as being in the public interest. Just as a little bit of preliminary background, for several years we have had back-to-back rate cases, or what some refer to as pancaking of rate cases. This creates uncertainty in the regulatory environment and in the business community in Utah. It increases the risk not only for the company, but for businesses and ratepayers as well. The settlement, as Mr. Taylor explained, is a multi-year settlement, which the division believes mitigates to a great extent the uncertainty. The outcome in the first step, including the rate design, is consistent or similar with the division's file positions in this rate case. That is, we believe that the $100 million in the rate design are just and reasonable. The outcome in the second step is consistent with the analysis performed by the division during the settlement negotiations and is consistent with our understanding of what future rate cases, and in particular if the company was to file a rate case in 2013, what the components of that rate case would be and possibly the outcome of that rate case. The stipulation also contains several rate mitigation or rate impact mitigation features that I would like to just touch on for a couple of minutes. As Mr. Taylor explained, the base net power costs for on a Utah basis is about $636 million. That's somewhat higher than what the division was recommending in the rate case, but we believe that this is more consistent with what the actual net power costs will be in the future. Base rates are set out, or EBA costs are set out in Table 2, which is based on the scalar method, the same method that we used in the last rate case. By setting the rates or the base net power costs a little bit higher than what the division had recommended in testimony, we believe that this will mitigate future rate impacts through EBA filing. There are also a couple of other rate mitigation factors dealing with net power costs, as Mr. Taylor actually explained. The $8.9 million, which is the subject of current docket before the commission, docket 12-035-67, will be refunded over a two-year period. Basically, the $8.9 million, other than the two-year deferral, is being treated in a normal fashion. When the company files its March 2013 filing under the EBA statute, interest will only accrue over the deferral period. There will be no interest over the amortization period. Stipulation also laid out two alternative methods for calculating base EBA costs. One is consistent, I think, with prior commission orders, and that is it's using the annual allocation factors. The other one, as Mr. Taylor pointed out, uses monthly allocation factors, which has been a subject of discussion in the past. Beginning with the effective date of the step one increase, base REC revenues will be set at $25 million. The division believes this is consistent with the evidence that we were able to gather in the rate case itself for the test period that the company used in its filing. However, we recognize that several contracts that the company has for REC revenues are expiring at the end of this year and very probably will not be renewed. In other words, we expect that in 2013, REC revenues will decrease substantially. As part of the stipulation to mitigate any future rate impact, we've set base REC revenues at $10 million effective with a step two increase. So in other words, the company would file for recovery of the difference or refunding of the difference between what's in base rate and what actually occurred, and we expect that there probably would be a substantial rate increase for customers absent the stipulation going forward. The accruals, again, also offer some rate mitigation impacts for customers. As Mr. Taylor explained, the accruals that occur this year or in 2012 will be amortized over a 12-month period. Well, in other words, we're treating those in a normal fashion. The accruals that occur in 2013 will be amortized over a 3-year period, and those in 2014 over a 2-year period, so that the amortization of those differences will end approximately the same time. As Mr. Taylor pointed out, there's no carrying charges on either the 2013 or the 2014 deferrals during that amortization period. So another important rate mitigation feature of the stipulation. Future rate cases, Mr. Taylor explained, will not be filed before January 1st of 2014, and that includes, or at least the effective date of any case that's filed prior to September of that same year. He also noted that in this next rate case filing, the company will address certain questions that the commission raised in an action request to the division during this rate case. Those issues dealt with consistent treatment of cash working capital, interest expense, and taxes. The company has agreed that they will propose a treatment a way of dealing with those issues in the next rate case as part of its regular filing, and then obviously parties can respond to that treatment the way they feel is appropriate. Mr. Taylor went over the depreciation study in quite a bit of detail, but again, I would just point out the rate mitigation features of that portion of the stipulation. The company is planning on filing, according to commission order, a depreciation study later this year. We would review that during 2013, and then, at least in my opinion and experience, typically what would happen is that those depreciation rates would become effective as part of, or as the commission ordered. Here the company has agreed to defer the collection of those costs until rates become effective in September of 2014 or approximately September of that year. I would point out that there's an asymmetric treatment in the in the stipulation with respect to the amounts of the depreciation study, and Mr. Taylor went over those. The company will collect only that amount above $2 million on a net difference, but it will refund a full amount on the net basis. Finally, let me just touch on the Klamath portion of the stipulation. This was, I think, an important feature for the division going into the negotiation for settlement of the rate case, and our position was is that it was not in the public interest to postpone treatment of Klamath beyond this rate case. And we believe that the settlement in this case for the Klamath is just and reasonable. Again, there is a rate mitigation feature. The company was asking for recovery from Utah of an allocated share of the removal costs, and the company has agreed in the stipulation that it will not seek recovery of those removal costs under the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement, or the CASA, as Mr. Taylor described. That includes any subsequent agreement. If the CASA happens to fail for one reason or another, and the company is able to enter into a new agreement similar to that, that the company will not seek removal costs from Utah if the dam is relicensed or is removed under the normal course of business, then we would address removal costs in some future rate case. Finally, paragraph 65, I would just note that despite the multi-year features of this particular settlement, the division has not, and the office has not, stipulated away in any way or compromised its ability to perform its duties under the statutes as described by Mr. Taylor. And that will conclude my remarks. Thank you.
One moment, please.
Just to be clear, the division does support the stipulation as providing for an opportunity or will provide for fair, for just and reasonable rates. And again, we believe that the stipulation is in the public interest and we recommend its approval. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Powell. Hearing none of Mr. Proctor, Ms. Beck.
Ms. Beck is the witness. Thank you.
Ms. Beck, have you been sworn in? Would you please stand or raise your right hand? You swear that the testimony you're about to give in this proceeding shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Michelle Beck. I'm the director of the Utah Office of Consumer Services. My business address is 160 East, 300 South, Salt Lake City, Utah. The office reviewed every aspect of this case and submitted the testimony of seven witnesses in the areas of cost of capital, return on equity, revenue requirement, net power costs, opposition to climate costs, cost of service, and residential rate design. The office also fully participated in all settlement discussions on behalf of the customers it represents, specifically the residential schedules, the irrigators of Schedule 10, and small commercial in Schedule 23. I'm here today to speak in favor of the settlement before the commission, and will focus my comments on the specifics that led to the office's support. So to first address the phase one increase, the office believes that the total phase one increase of $100 million is reasonable. The office notes that the 9.8% ROE included in this settlement would be the lowest allowed ROE in Utah in many years. And it believes that it is appropriate to set the ROE below 10% given the current economic climate and the testimony and record in this proceeding. We also note that the office's case would have been approximately $97 million at the 9.8% ROE level. The stipulation also includes the reasonable settlement of the Klamath issues with a compromised position on depreciation of life, the inclusion of process costs but at a lower carrying cost than originally requested, and the explicit exclusion of the Klamath Dam removal costs. Excluding the dam removal costs results in a decrease of $7.4 million in the phase one increase, but the total savings is closer to $75 million over the next 10 years. The office also notes that the agreement is very clear, as Dr. Powell already stated, that the company cannot later request recovery of dam removal costs from Utah ratepayers if other funding sources in the KHSA do not materialize. The company can only seek cost recovery if the KHSA agreement is dissolved and relicensing at FERC is pursued at some time in the future. So next to the phase two increase, incorporating a full year's revenue requirement for the new Mona to Ogre transmission line and resetting the level of REC revenue, as Dr. Powell described, that is included in base rates, accounts for approximately $40 million of the phase two increase. The office believes it is in the public interest to agree to that increase at this time rather than pursue a full rate case next year. The office also notes that it has reviewed the company's business plan and other confidential documents that clearly support an additional rate increase of an additional $14 million. However, the office is not comfortable using documents outside the scope of the record in this case to justify such an increase. Alternatively, the office has calculated the value of the other concessions made by the company within this case and finds that they more than offset the additional $14 million. For this reason, the office is comfortable supporting the phase two increase of $54 million as part of this settlement. The office notes that the implementation is contingent upon the Mona Oka line going into service and important protection since that line is the greatest single component justifying the phase two increase. Now to rate design and rate spread. The office supports the rate spread included in the stipulation as representing a reasonable compromise among a wide range of proposals. The office supports the rate design proposal for residential customers, which includes an increase of the residential customer charge to $5. While this customer charge is slightly higher than the office's calculation of cost of service, it remains tied to the cost causation principle and should not be further increased unless and until a higher level is justified with evidence that is also clearly tied to cost of service. The office also supports the move to a two-tiered non-summer energy rate, similar to what was proposed in our testimony, as it provides better price signals throughout the year and better matches cost of service principles. By splitting the non-summer rate, parties were able to develop and agree to energy rates that resulted in a much fairer bill impact, especially for the low-use customers. We note that the second tier of the non-summer rate remains lower than the second tier in the summer. This was done primarily in the spirit of gradualism as we are implementing a new rate element. Overall, the office is pleased with the residential rate design included in the stipulation and finds the resulting price signals and bill impacts to be fair, reasonable, and consistent with key rate design principles. So in conclusion, in the office's judgment, the settlement is in the public interest and will result in just and reasonable rates, and we recommend commission approval.
Thank you, Ms. Beck. Are there parties who wish to cross-examine Ms. Beck? Presumably not. Okay. Thank you. Let's turn now to Mr. Dodge, UAE.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin Higgins of UAE will offer a brief testimony in support of the stipulation and then be available for any questions.
And Mr. Higgins is not the sworn either. Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give in this proceeding shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of UAE, I recommend approval of the stipulation by the Commission. The stipulation is in the public interest because it minimizes the level of rate increase for customers while still affording Rocky Mountain Power an opportunity to earn a reasonable return on investment. A key feature of the stipulation is that it takes a holistic view of several important interrelated issues, which include the going forward revenue requirements for the company, including recovery of its investment costs and net power costs, proper treatment of deferred accounting requests associated with the Carbon and Naughton plant, anticipated changes in future depreciation rates, and the overall impact on customer rates over a multi-year period. Taking account of these interrelated issues, the stipulation proposes a means to enable the company to recover its prudently incurred costs while smoothing out and minimizing the overall rate impact on customers. Now, I would just like to highlight several provisions of the agreement that are of particular importance to UAE. First, I'd like to comment on the evaluation of the two-step increase. And the approach that we took at UAE closely parallels the description that Ms. Beck provided to you. That is, even though the total sum of the two-step increase is below the request the company made in its rebuttal filing, nevertheless, we really needed to take a realistic view of what the going forward cost recovery would likely be were the company to file a second rate increase, a second rate case shortly after the conclusion of this case. And based on our evaluation of that, we believe the second step rate increase of $54 million is reasonable. As Ms. Beck pointed out, it's important to recognize that the mere reduction in REC revenues in base rates from $25 million to $10 million, which is included in the stipulation, by itself would be a $15 million rate increase. That explains 15 of the 54 million. And then when one takes into account the strong likelihood of the completion of the Mona to Oker transmission line in the near future, that would explain a good deal of up to another a total of $40 million of the $54 million in step two. So taking those factors into account and in exchange for the entire package and some of the other considerations in the package, including getting some base rate certainty, we felt that the two-step increase was and is a reasonable outcome. I should also point out that the two-step increase, both step one and step two, come packaged with net power cost values as well as already been mentioned, REC values. And that's a very important part of the entire package because from a customer perspective, one of the things UAE was trying to achieve, and I know other customer interests were trying to achieve, is to minimize the potential for later rate adjustments that would occur as a result of the parameters adopted in this agreement. In other words, knowing that there's an EBA adjuster out there, that it's important in preparing a settlement agreement to take into account the likelihood of a future EBA adjustment based on the parameters in the agreement. And I believe that the parameters adopted in this agreement minimize the likelihood of future EBA adjustments. Of course, we can't remove future EBA adjustments over the term of the agreement. We can't remove the risk of such adjustments, but I believe that the parties made a strong, good faith effort to not kick the can down the road, if you will, in that regard. And so that's another aspect of the settlement that commends it to the Commission. With respect to REC revenues, there is a strong likelihood that they are going to decline, and customers will feel the impact of that. However, this settlement also attempts to make it as soft a landing as possible by building in a reduction in anticipated REC revenues for step two. Briefly, a couple of other points that commend the settlement to you. It does produce a reasonable rate spread, and of note, the rate spread does include projected revenues from special contract customers to help offset the rate increase for remaining customers. As it has been discussed, it resolves a number of recurring issues associated with cost recovery related to the climate hydroelectric settlement agreement. And I believe this stipulation resolves those issues in a manner that is both fair to the company, but which also protects Utah customers and minimizes their exposure or limits their exposure, I should say, to certain climate hydroelectric settlement agreement related costs. So with that, I recommend to you approval of the settlement agreement in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Higgins. Does any party wish to cross-examine Mr. Higgins? Okay, Attorney Adam is Baldwin. Do you have a witness supporting the...
No, we have no witness supporting the stipulation. We would just like to say that we do fully support and recommend the commission approve the stipulation.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Baldwin. Ms. Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sarah Wright will be our witness, and she has not yet been sworn.
Okay. Please stand and raise your right hand, Ms. Baldwin. Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give in this proceeding? Ms. Wright, I mean, so many Sarahs in our lives. I'm so sorry that you said Sarah. Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give in this proceeding shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, good morning. My name is Sarah Wright. I'm the Executive Director of Utah Clean Energy. My business address is 1014 2nd Avenue, Salt Lake City, Utah, 84103. I filed direct testimony in this docket on behalf of Utah Clean Energy. Utah Clean Energy participated in the settlement discussions that led to this agreement, with particular focus on residential redesign. Utah Clean Energy's mission is to lead and accelerate the clean energy transformation with vision and expertise. We work to stop energy waste, create clean energy, and build a smart energy future. Utah Clean Energy views residential rate design as an important component of smart energy policy. Utah Clean Energy supports the stipulation as just and reasonable and in the public interest. With regard to residential rate design, the stipulation represents a compromise for Utah Clean Energy, but affects changes that promote energy efficiency and conservation, and is, on the whole, a positive step for residential rate design from the current residential rate structure. Although the proposed residential rate structure still includes a minimum bill, it has been maintained at the current $7 level. Therefore, it will not additionally undermine Utah's net metering policy. Additionally, the proposed residential rate design changes volumetric energy rates to send stronger price signals to conserve energy in both the summer and the non-summer seasons. Specifically, changes to the energy rate include higher increases in the second and third summer block rates compared to the first block rate, and the important creation of a second non-summer block rate, which we have not done previously. This sends the message that the cost of energy increases with consumption and provides motivation for customers to decrease usage out of the higher block. Furthermore, parties have expressed a commitment to investigate ways of improving bill messaging to residential customers to further encourage efficiency and conservation. On a whole, this stipulation is a step in the right direction for effectuating smart energy policies, and Utah Clean Energy recommends the Commission's approval. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. Do you have any party wish to press it down, Ms. Wright? Okay, we passed over Ms. Smith. Have you a witness supporting the stipulation?
Mr. Chairman, Walmart does not oppose the stipulation.
Good enough.
Thank you.
Mr. Dubuque, have you, by the way, my great-grandmother was a Dubuque, Soproni Dubuque, so they were probably related. Have you a witness supporting the stipulation?
No, Mr. Chairman, we do not. We do report approval.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Parties on the telephone, have you anything to say in support of the stipulation?
This is Captain Miller for FEA. I don't have a witness, obviously. I'd just like to express that the federal executive agencies support the settlement agreement in its entirety. And we wish that the commission would approve the agreement. Thank you.
Thank you for participating, Captain Miller.
This is Jody Kyler with the Kroger Company. We don't have a witness in support of the stipulation, but Kroger does fully support the stipulation and recommends its approval.
Thank you, Ms. Kyler. Thank you for your contribution to the proceeding today. Are there any parties who opposed the stipulation? Mr. Taylor represented that he didn't know of any. I don't know of any. I haven't received anything in writing. And we, in fact, sent out a second notice trying to find out if there were people who did. Okay, seeing that, let's turn now then to commission questions, and we'll go to Commissioner Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. With comprehensive settlement like this, by the way, and multiple dockets, I also want to take an opportunity to thank our professional staff. It's nice to run these, have discussion and run some of these questions past them, make sure the research is done to see if we're missing anything so that we have perfect clarity when our questions are answered. Of course, perfect clarity is always subject to check, but anyway. Mr. Taylor, on page 2, item 3, is there an error stated in the forecast test period? It says May 31st, 2012. Should that be 2013? The forecast period should be in the future.
Which paragraph are you reading?
It is item 3, page 2, item 3, and it's towards the bottom sentence.
Yes, that is incorrect.
Okay, so we'll make that change to 2013. Thank you. On page 14, item 55, make reference to a technical conference concerning the stress factor study, but I don't know if we've actually keep that up as a commissioner. Are you expected our order to include setting up that tech conference?
I don't know that you need to schedule it as part of the order. What we're asking is that we're going to request, that the parties will request that you set a technical conference. It's probably preliminary to set that up because we don't have the information laid out in front of you yet, but what we're requesting is when that information is prepared, that you then schedule a technical conference to review that.
Okay, good enough. On page 14 and item 57, you talk about field messaging to customers, and this might be for Dr. Appel too. Who's going to be following that, taking the charge on making sure that happens and that the process is completed for the customer bill?
Well, there are obligations to the company here that we've agreed to do. There are other parties very interested in this issue, so I'm absolutely sure that they will be following up with us to make sure this happens. But ultimately, I think it ultimately rests in the company's court to make sure that this happens. And again, this agreement is just to have a discussion about it. There's no commitment at this point. If there will be a change, but we've agreed to sit down and talk about specific issues to see if there is a better way to present the company's pricing structures or whatever on the bill that's actually more informative and helpful to our customers.
Okay, great. So you're taking the lead and you'll have input from the usual suspects. Okay, great. Well, let's see, I had a question about the Mona to Oka transmission line, but it sounds like in your summary you covered that. It's on schedule. Is that what I heard?
Yes, it's the current target date for completion is May of 2013, which is several months before the step 2 increase. So all indications are that we will have that line completed well before that date.
Okay, great. Those are my questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Campbell.
I have just a few questions. I think I'll start at the back and work my way forward. On page 16, paragraph 60, for the record, could someone just define and differentiate decommissioning from dam removal? What's the difference between decommissioning costs and dam removal?
I will step to the edge of my skis and address it. The decommissioning is defined in that agreement for very specific costs, but there are certain obligations that the company has to do to the dam before removal can take place. Now, I'm not familiar with exactly what those are, but there are very clearly laid out things in that agreement that the company is required to do before the dam removal process actually takes place.
Do you have any insight and spec as far as what the difference between decommissioning versus removal?
May I answer that question?
Yeah, please.
Commissioner Campbell. Decommissioning is defined in the KHSA as one, requiring that the company remove essentially its personal property from the dam site, and to acquire its salvage value. And I don't know precisely what that property would be, but it would be electronic control equipment, that sort of thing, chairs, tables, whatever, that you wouldn't want to have to haul away to a dump, essentially, that may have value. The other major part of decommissioning is to disconnect the dam from the grid. The dam removal, and that is something that PacifiCorp has agreed to do and is obligated to do. The dam removal takes place under the direction or actually is performed by a separate entity, not PacifiCorp. And that's exactly what it means. The structure itself is removed in various, over a period of time or whatever. So
within the agreement, the KHSA, those are very defined terms, and they're understood which costs go in which bucket.
They're very carefully defined, yes.
I'd like to go to item 45 on page 10. Says that first sentence, the parties agree we should recover and refund the deferred depreciation expense. And it's the phrase that I want to understand a little better, as modified by future cost of service studies and future rate cases. What does that mean?
Well, this deferral, this reg asset, will, in the cost of service study, it will be, the company will propose that it be allocated a certain way, and that particular allocation may change over time. So that's what this is addressing here. Is this is an element of cost that will be in the company's revenue requirement, is treated in the cost of service, and as any element in the cost of service, there's an allocation method to allocate that across customer rate schedules. And from case to case, parties in the company may propose a different allocation of those costs.
So it doesn't change the level or the amount of cost within the deferral.
It's just within the cost of service.
What portion of that?
That's exactly right. It's a who pays question within the conference.
Okay, my final question is on, I think, page 6, item number 30, where it says that the parties established that the $636 million annually in the Utah electric basis should be established as base NPC. And I guess my question is, and this kind of came up last week in a hearing, is that level, is the $636 a prudent level of net power cost?
That's the level that was included in the company's rebuttal. So from the company's perspective, that's a very prudent level, and that's our best current projection of what those costs will be.
Do the other witnesses want to comment on prudency, or whether that's a prudent level of expenditure?
I would say yes, it is a prudent level. As I tried to explain in our filed testimony, we had proposed a level that was less than this. If I remember right, it was about $619 million. A lot of those adjustments were based on modeling issues, different ways of modeling different things. But as we studied net power costs through the negotiations and as part of the rate case, we believe that this is closer to what the actual net power costs will be. The bottom line is we believe it's a prudent cost.
I may have a different answer. I'm confused a little bit by the question, and I was in the room during that discussion to which you refer, but is it a prudent level? We think it's a reasonable level to be included in base rates, and a level that won't skew what kind of true-up we see in the subsequent June 1 true-up filings, or the March filings for June 1 implementation, but it does not specify a specific set of costs. So I don't think there could be a presumption that what that the first X amount of dollars are prudent and then the next are at issue. I think when the company files in March, there may be specific line items that parties will want to come in and challenge based on prudence. So it's not going to just be a simple accounting filing of does, you know, X minus Y equals Z, and that's what gets recovered from customers. I think that there needs to be a line-by-line prudence review in the EDA filing, because this does not include a set of very specific costs that have been agreed as prudent.
Thank you. Anybody else want to weigh in? I'm not disagreeing with anything that Ms. Beck said. The division's analysis of what it believes are being proposed as in rates are prudent. And that's represented by the $636 million here in the stipulation. We agree with Ms. Beck that once the company makes a filing, the actual costs are subject to a prudence review. And that may be different as a recommendation on 636, but that would deal with the actual net power costs that's filed by the company.
So if the company files $630 million in the EBA filing, the parties could still propose that some of those costs actually were imprudently incurred.
That's my understanding, yes. Okay, thank you. Do the parties wish to put anything else on the record before we recess? Okay, in that case, we will be in recess until 5 o'clock this evening, when we will hear from public witnesses. Thank you all.